You might be wondering, why is this very old, tattered, burnt painting of the Sacred Heart behind me? Well, you know, on Friday we celebrated the solemnity and patronal feast of our parish of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And the painting behind me is the original painting that hung in this church in 1880. Now, when I first came across the painting in a back closet against the wall, facing the wall, covered by tons of other things stored in that closet, I looked at it and said, it's old, it's burnt, it's torn up, it's probably impossible to restore. It's historical, so let me call the archives department of the Archdiocese of Denver and see if they'll take it. They told me it's too big, there's no place to store it, we can't take it. And so I briefly entertained the idea of, should I throw it away? I mean, it's burnt, it's damaged, it's probably impossible to restore. As you can see, it's not been kept up. And then in talking with a few people from the Archdiocese, it dawned on us that this is probably the original painting of the church that Julia Greeley, the servant of God, whose image is by the statue of the Sacred Heart of Jesus to my left, to your right, who was baptized, confirmed, First Communion, went to daily mass here, even worked as an employee at this parish for about 8 months, and is now being considered for canonization. This is the painting she looked at every day when she came to daily mass. This is the painting that she prayed to every day as she became a Catholic and a missionary disciple in Denver, the angel of charity, helping the poor, those even less poor than herself, praying for firefighters and being a mother, a spiritual mother to the children of our school. And because we realized Julia Greeley looked at this painting, we knew we couldn't throw it away. One day, God willing, she will be canonized and this will be a relic. But it speaks to the history of our church. In many ways, because of its poverty for many, many, many decades, it has been unkept. Things have kind of fallen apart. It's expensive to maintain things, but as we're learning, even more expensive to repair them when they're not maintained. And it's been burned. Burned because in 1910, someone tried to burn the church down. We've always been a church of immigrants. In 1910 and prior to, they were Irish and Italian Catholics. Denver, or Colorado, was the second largest Ku Klux Klan membership in the United States of America, second only to Indiana. And someone tried to burn the church down. The message was clear: you're an immigrant and we don't want you here. Back then, it was Italian and Irish Catholics. Now it's Mexican and Hispanic Catholics. Not much have changed. And the painting was damaged by the fire. If you come and look at it later on the bottom right corner or your left, you'll see the clear char of the wood frame that damaged the painting, potentially irreparably so. But the wisdom of the pastor in 1910 was not to throw it away. And the wisdom of the parishioners in response to the arson attempt to destroy their church was to use the insurance money and make it bigger. You don't want us here? Well, don't worry, we'll bring more. And here we are, 145 years later, in that same church. Looking at this painting, any unaware person, like myself, could be tempted or would just simply throw it away. But because Julia Greeley looked upon it, even though it's been burned and damaged and mishandled and is old, we have kept it. Because Julia Greeley looked upon it. How much more are we valuable in the eyes of Christ because he has looked upon us? Many of us, like Peter, are in chains, not in a literal prison as he was for proclaiming the gospel, but chains of believing I'm not wanted. I should be discarded. My spouse left me. My kids no longer speak to me. I rarely talk to my grandkids. I'm a widow. I'm a widower. No one wants me. I'm poor. I don't speak English. I don't speak Spanish. We can believe the lies of how others have looked upon us with hateful vengeance, racism, or just their own issues of alcoholism, drug addiction, mental illness. And when they're a parent or a grandparent or a figure of importance in our lives, the way they look at us gives us this feeling of shame and guilt and worthlessness that we then begin to believe maybe it's better we just throw myself away. We forget about the fact that it's Jesus who looks upon us. For Peter, the Lord sent an angel to set him free. The Lord sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting. The Lord sends an angel to you and I to rescue us from the hand of the chains of the lies we believe about ourselves and reminds us that I have looked upon you. And what I see is not something to be discarded, but something for which my son suffered, died, and rose again to be redeemed. People could have said to Peter, it's better you just leave. You denied him 3 times. He called you Satan when he told you that he was going to be arrested and killed and risen, and you insisted, no, Lord, let that not happen to you. Get behind me, Satan. You're thinking as man does, not as God. Peter, what are you doing, really? If Jesus himself called you Satan, if you denied him 3 times, if you picked up the sword and became violent when they arrested him, contrary to what Jesus said, really, maybe you should just leave. But instead, Jesus appears to Peter after the resurrection and asks him 3 times, do you love me? And in that 3-time exchange, his denials are forgiven, and Christ tells him, feed my sheep, tend my flock. One day you will bear witness to me. And so it became. Peter would eventually be crucified, and by his own insistence, upside down, considering himself unworthy to die in the manner of Christ. Crucified because he was a non-Roman citizen. Crucified because he proclaimed Jesus is Lord and not Caesar. That was an insurrectionist philosophy and idea, and the Roman government made sure anyone who refused to worship Caesar as Lord would be killed. Peter happily went to the cross in imitation of his Lord. And the angel of the Lord did rescued him from death, and now he reigns in heaven. Paul could have equally been considered, at the very best, discardable, but more likely completely rejectable. Why? Because he was the greatest enemy of the early church. Under the name Saul, he persecuted the church, and he fought to crush this messianic movement. He was the most Jew of the Jews. He was the most zealous of the zealots. He was an expert of the law, and he defended the faith with zeal beyond anyone else, even facilitating the death, the martyrdom of the deacon, Saint Stephen. But Jesus, risen from the dead, appears to Paul on his way to Damascus to round up, arrest, and kill more Christians. And he looks at Paul in the eye. Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Saul goes blind. His old self, no longer able to see, he is taken by some Christians to a home where he fasts for days. Ananias is called by Jesus to go pray over him. And as Ananias forgives him and prays over him, scales fall from his eyes and he's able to see again now with true faith. Because Christ looked at him, he went from an enemy of the church to its greatest proclaimer and preacher, bringing the gospel to the Gentile peoples, while Peter brought the gospel to the Jewish peoples. He ends up becoming author of half of the books in the New Testament, because Jesus looked upon him. Now, Paul knew that salvation happens in that encounter. It happens through baptism, but it must continually be worked out. We must continually cooperate with God's grace to win the race of salvation and to keep the faith and to compete well. All because Jesus looked upon him. Saul became Paul. The enemy became the great proclaimer of Christ risen. Ultimately, when we are looked upon by the one who made us in love and for love, the lies and chains of what we believed about who we are break away. And we recognize in his gaze that I am called to holiness and happiness. We set aside the things keeping us from the sacraments as we knowingly live a life contrary to the commandments, and we decide no more, Lord. Better that I live and die for you than for the sin or the things of this world or the embrace of another who's not my husband or my wife. Better I live for you and trust that you will bless me more than I could ever do for myself. Ultimately, we're at a point of decision. Peter and Paul made their decision to the point of shedding their blood for Christ. But you and I must decide, who is your God? And that decision's not through words, it's through action. It's not just through the profession of faith, which we will do shortly, but it's through frequent confession and frequent communion and living a life of faith, loving God and our neighbor. It's proven in action, and we must decide. Jesus knew that. Even after years with the apostles, he takes them to the region of Caesarea Philippi, and he actually is standing where at the mountain separating Israel today from Lebanon, where the streams of the River Jordan begin, the ice and snow melt, and the Jordan River is created where Christ was baptized, where the Israelites passed through to get to the promised land while Moses was buried on the other side. The river is significant, but Jesus takes him to Caesarea Philippi because etched into the side of the mountain are these massive stone figures of gods that the Roman Empire worshipped. Jesus stands with the Roman gods behind him, etched in the side of the mountain, with the context of the most powerful army and empire the world has ever known. And he has the apostles face him. And he tells them essentially, you must choose. Will you worship the gods of Rome? Or will you worship me? Who do you say that I am? In the face of all these gods, of the people who oppress you, of the most powerful empire and army the world has ever known to that point, who do you say that I am? Because the Roman proclaims Caesar is Lord, but the Christian proclaims Jesus is Lord. Christ takes them to the beginning of the Jordan River and then moves south into Jerusalem for his passion and death. But first, they must decide. Peter speaks up, and he speaks the truth revealed to him by God. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. We will march into Jerusalem and to our death, proclaiming that you are Lord and not Caesar. Jesus, in response, tells Peter, you are the rock upon which I will build my church. If you don't know, the city of Jerusalem is literally built on a rock. But Peter now is the rock. His bones are in Rome, as are those of St. Paul. And literally, St. Peter's is built upon the bones of Peter, hidden in rock centuries ago, so that the Romans would not find his bones, cremate them, and spread the ashes so that there would be nothing left to venerate. Preserved in stone, St. Peter's was built not knowing exactly where the bones were, only to be discovered in the 1940s to be literally and directly under the center of the dome of St. Peter, below the main altar, hidden in stone. You are rock, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of the netherworld shall not prevail against it. In the 1940s, we realized that these words were literally true. All because Peter decided in that moment and by his death, Jesus is Lord and no one else. So the question for you today, as we honor the great apostles Peter and Paul, is a question Jesus places to you and me, of which the answer will be given in action, not in words, in active celebration and reception of the sacraments and following Jesus based on the Ten Commandments, not by observing from a distance in a pew. Who do you say that I am?